Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Tuesday, January 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. African leaders are urged to wake up to human rights and regional security challenges posed by the Sudan conflict.
I'm calling on the international community to really get its act together, gear up for the challenge, and meet that challenge in the face of this major crisis.
Thousands of South Sudanese in Sudan's Western Kordofan province are moving back home because of the Sudan conflict. Sexual violence survivors in Nigeria call for tougher laws against perpetrators. The African Private Sector Summit calls on current and aspiring African leaders to make democracy an opportunity for the continent.
If we have political leaders understanding that their first priority is to improve the quality of lives of their citizens, and that the way to improve the quality of life is to create an environment in which those citizens create wealth, then you have a very good outcome.
And hundreds of Israeli soldiers and civilians are getting a unique treatment for PTSD. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Sudan analyst is calling on African leaders and the international community to wake up to the human rights and regional security challenges posed by the conflict in Sudan. Suleiman Baldo, director of the Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker, says the international community should rise to the challenge and not abandon the people of Sudan. This comes as Rapid Support Forces RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Daglo Hemeti has been touring several African countries, expressing his willingness for an unconditional ceasefire. Baldo tells me that instead of treating Hemeti as a statesman, African leaders should put maximum pressure, including sanctions, on him and Sudan military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan.
He is trying to establish some legitimacy for himself as a statesman, and is being given that opportunity by heads of states and governments in Africa for their own reasons. I don't know why, because he's the head of a genocidal militia that is wreaking havoc in Sudan. It's a well-established record of mass atrocities, war crimes, crimes against humanity, is well-established and independently reported. So I don't know why African heads of state are giving the man all this presidential reception and recognition. I don't see it as necessary for getting him to a negotiating table. On the contrary, they should have dealt with him without according him that recognition.
But could it be perhaps that Africa is tired of the killing and the war in Sudan, and they are willing to accept at least a peaceful resolution?
Well, you get a peaceful recognition by, avoiding to give recognition and legitimacy to those who are committing the killings and the atrocities. Both the head of the army and the head of the Rapid Support Forces are responsible for the destruction of Sudan and the uprooting of its population. And they should not be given that legitimacy by the international community. And in the fairest order of things, they should not be given that legitimacy by the African heads of state and governments.
But how do you bring about peace without the heads of the warring parties?
You put maximum pressure on them. You deny them recognition. You impose economic embargoes on them. This is how you do it. And you do it as part of a regional and international integrated coordinated strategy.
I noticed that the military leader, Burhan, has also rejected what Daglo is doing.
Yes, he was sort of irritated by the reception Daglo has received. And now he's saying he's no longer interested. Having agreed to this meeting, what happened is that in between, MIT has surfaced and began this regional tour and received all this official recognition from several member states of the IGAD, Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, Djibouti. He has been to all these states and was received, as a statesman. And that's a major reason why, Burhan is today is no longer interested in negotiating a solution. I don't think this is the right attitude, but it's a response, and an angry response, I think, to the reception that Hemeti has received.
From where you sit, do you think some movement is being made towards peace?
At this time, you know, there was a window of opportunity, as they said, by the invitation of the IGAD for this summit between Burhan and Hameti. This window appeared to have been closed, given the development which we just discussed. That is to say, the regional tour of Hameti. But he may still be interested in meeting Hameti under some other convening, mediating a team, you know. Could it be Jeddah? Could it be the African Union or United Nations? All these actors really need to rise up to the challenge of one of the main crises in the world in terms of its human rights and humanitarian cost, in terms of the risk it poses to regional security and international security. But none of them so far has a clear strategy on how they are going to approach peacemaking in Sudan. They should really, you know, be answering this question, what next, now that the possibility of a meeting under IGAD is seeming to be escaping us, you know. And therefore, I'm calling on the international community to really get its act together, gear up for the challenge, and meet that challenge and not abandon the people of Sudan while they are just, I don't know what they are doing in the face of this major crisis, except issuing statements. You know, we haven't seen much action.
Suleiman Baldo is the director of the Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. He was speaking with us from the state of New Jersey, USA. Thousands of South Sudanese at Liri refugee camp in Sudan's western quarterfan are moving back home because of the conflict between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces. Authorities in Upper Nile State say the South Sudanese refugees have spent over 8 months without food, water, and medical supplies. Ibrahim Memer reports from Malakai.
South Sudanese refugees at Liri camp in Sudan's western Kordofan say they lack access to life-saving humanitarian assistance. Isaac Kir, the coordinator of South Sudanese refugees in Liri refugee camp, says the camp was cut off from aid workers when fighting erupted last April, leaving the refugees without food and water.
People in Liri are in bad situation because they have not received food assistance since February 2023. When the conflict in Sudan started in April 2023, humanitarian corridors were closed. People are suffering due to lack of food and water. Last month, we asked NGO to provide transport to the stranded refugee in Liri, but there's still no help.
Kier says some children and elderly persons die daily at the camp, adding that the refugees are waiting for United Nations agencies to repatriate them to Tonga in Panyikang County.
If you are a refugee and you don't have any food and you don't work 8 months without food assistance and they don't have any work, that is why a lot of people are dying. Children and elderly are dying. We are waiting for the organization to come to take them from Liri to their areas. We are not able to give you the number, but daily 2, 3, 4 die.
Gabriel Oloy, County Coordinator for South Sudan's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, says some refugees lack the money for transportation and have traveled to Tonga on foot.
Those who came, they are the people who are able. Some come on footing with their children. Those who can see themselves, they have effort to come. Some they are using motorbike, those who have a little money. But what they tell us a lot, it is a way of hiring some vehicle to use. It's difficult because there is no money. There is a much number of children because only we saw women carrying children, but we know that there are some children who are separated.
Oloch says his office is mobilizing non-profit groups to help repatriate the refugees. He says the International Organization for Migration is well informed about the plight of the South Sudanese stranded in Sudan.
ROC is still mobilizing the resources from NGOs like IOM. Even the time we went for rough assessment, IOM was there with us. And through interview, they get all the information that people want to come back because life is too hot for them and there's no way to let them come. They say they are going also to send the message and they are going to mobilize. But now, due to the Christmas Inn, we didn't get more information how far they reached.
The camp in Liri was opened after the outbreak of South Sudan's 2013 conflict. Oloch says many people fled on foot to western Kordofan to seek refuge. Panyikang County authorities say 1,408 refugees from Liri camp arrived in Tonga this week. For VOA News, I am Amer Abraham Kwot in Malakal.
Ethiopia says it held talks Monday on military cooperation with Somaliland. This just a week after a deal with the breakaway Somali region on sea access stoked tensions in the Horn of Africa. The French news agency, the AFP, says the discussion in Addis Ababa were held the same day that Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed began a visit to neighboring Eritrea. Somalia is seeking international support over the controversial January 1 agreement between Ethiopia and Somaliland, a separatist region over which Mogadishu exercises little real authority. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 9th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The new chair of the Board of Directors and Advisory Board of the Africa Private Sector Summit is calling on current and aspiring African leaders to make democracy an opportunity for the continent. This, as over 15 African countries, including Senegal, South Sudan, and South Africa, are scheduled to have elections in 2024. Professor Kingsley Mungalu, who is also former deputy governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, is urging African governments to adopt a charter on a private sector bill of rights that facilitates trade and investment in Africa. He tells me the measure includes the right to peace, security, and stability, and effective legal systems that protect the sanctity of business contracts.
Private sector investments in Africa depend to a very large extent on how, you know, private sector businessmen and women perceive the business environment in each African country, and of course, interconnectedly across African countries as well, in the context of intra-African trade. So, you know, the kinds of leaders we elect determine to a large extent their aptitude or their stand or their body language towards the private sector. If you have leaders who understand how wealth is created by the private sector and who believe that the private sector should drive wealth creation, not the government, the government should provide an enabling environment and the right kind of policy framework. But the actual trading, buying and selling, industrialization, all those things, services, they're all delivered by private sector businesses, whether they're big corporations or whether they are small and medium enterprises. So if we have political leaders understanding that their first priority as leaders is to improve the quality of lives of their citizens, and that the way to improve the quality of life is to create an environment in which those citizens create wealth, then you have a very good outcome.
This past November, Professor, I interviewed Mr. J. Wendell Adit. I think he's your predecessor. He talked about the need for African governments to adopt a private sector bill of rights. Yes. What is the importance of this private sector bill of rights?
We are advocating that African leaders adopt a charter on a bill of rights for the private sector that has 24 specific rights. That if every African country adopts these rights, if it is adopted at the Assembly of Heads of States and Government of the African Union in February 2025 and applied in practice, will make the landscape for intra-African trade and investment very inviting indeed, and will help create wealth on the continent. Now, this Bill of Rights is a codification. It's like a charter, it's a commitment by governments to empower the private sector to really drive the African continental free trade area. And we have specific rights that We are asking them to agree to such as the right to peace and security for business to be able to thrive. If you have conflicts going on in various African countries or between African countries, it's very disruptive for people to be able to do business in such an environment. Or if you have terrorists, you know, agents attacking sovereign states, rendering them partially failed states, poverty is the outcome, period. So guaranteeing security, peace, and stability is number one. We want them to commit to a taxation framework that is very simplified and avoids multiple taxes, which we know many SMEs in many African countries complain about. We want a legal system that works, where contracts are sanctified and the legal process is efficient. We want the private sector to be consulted, you know, when decisions or policies or regulations are made, so that those decisions can actually work. These are the practical things that make doing business in Africa very, very difficult.
What does it take for most African governments to adopt this Bill of Rights? And what are some of the hiccups to its adoption?
Well, first of all, what it will take is political will. That's the number one thing. Second is the understanding of how economies work, especially the African Continental Free Trade Area, which has the potential to increase Africa's GDP by almost $500 billion, you know, by 2035, and to take 30 million people out of poverty if we improve and increase trade between African countries, not just between Africa and the wider world, because that kind of trade has us in a weak position. So, you know, the more we trade within Africa, the more prosperity we can create for Africans.
Professor Kingsley Mahalu is the new chair of the Board of Directors and the Advisory Board of the Africa Private Sector Summit. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Nigeria's President Bola Ahmed Tinubu suspended his poverty minister on Monday following allegations that she diverted public funds into a private bank account. According to the French news agency AFP, the measure against humanitarian affairs and poverty alleviation minister Beta Edu came days after another senior official was suspended over corruption charges. Nigeria is a signatory to several international treaties aiming at ending sexual and gender-based violence against women. However, the problem persists. Now, some want new laws to hold offenders accountable. Timothy Obiezu has this story from Jos Plateau State, Nigeria.
Inside these walls in central Nigeria's Plateau State are women seeking refuge from sexual violence. Stella Kenneth was raped by her father in 2017 when she was 10 years old.
My father started touching my body, and one day he called me aside after our devotion, and he said, "I'm trying to teach you what life is, so no guy will come and deceive you. I love you." I was scared that if I tell it out, my father is going to beat me and I'll stop paying my school fees.
The abuse continued until last year when Kenneth told a family friend what was happening and they reported it to the authorities who arrested her father. She says the experience impacted her self-esteem.
When I came, I was not friendly. I was kind of rugged. Rugged, not too that kind of socialized. Always kind of be like a bad person, like bad girl.
The nonprofit Christian Women for Excellence and Empowerment in Nigerian Society launched in 2010 and says the Safe House is helping many survivors of sexual violence like Kenneth cope with the trauma. Violence against women and girls is on the rise more than 20 years after Nigeria signed the Maputo Protocol, an African charter on women's rights. Recently, the French ambassador to Nigeria, Emmanuel Bletman, said economic challenges in the country are driving the increase in the number of cases of gender-based violence. 18-year-old Kachola Musa says she was raped by her uncle 8 years ago. She says she's still afraid to report the case to her family.
I lied and I told them that someone wanted to kidnap me. So after then I regret it. I was afraid to report the case.
In December, Nigerian lawmakers called for a review of the laws to enable enforcement agents to take decisive measures. Janet Beatrice, the safe house manager at Plateau, is all for a review of current laws.
For me, I think either life imprisonment or death sentence can even serve as a deterrent to others out there. Because the gravity of this offense is a lifetime memory that has been created in the heart and in the life of the victim.
Beatrice says harsher laws and stronger enforcement could act as a deterrent and help women here feel safe. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Jos, Plateau State, Nigeria.
Hundreds of Israeli soldiers and civilians suffering trauma from the Hamas attack of October 7 and the ensuing war in Gaza are getting a unique treatment for PTSD in hyperbaric oxygen chambers. Doctors say it physically helps the brain heal from trauma. Linda Greystein reports for VOA from Shamir Hospital in the central Israeli city of Rishon LeZion.
Shachar Mizrahi suffered from severe post-traumatic stress disorder after fighting in the war against Hamas in Gaza 10 years ago. He could sleep only an hour and a half a night, tormented by nightmares and flashbacks, and rarely left his house or communicated with people. No therapeutic treatments helped until he heard about hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
I came here like a dead man, dead, walking dead. And I was feel like I don't have nothing in my life that can help me. So I put all my I did all in this therapy.
After 60 daily sessions of high pressure oxygen treatments, Shachar's PTSD symptoms improved significantly, allowing him to sleep, study, develop a career, and even get engaged to be married. But the ongoing war in Gaza triggered his PTSD condition, so he has returned to the Hyperbaric Medicine Center for another cycle of treatments he intends to finish before his upcoming wedding.
Now where the war starts, so everything back for me, like, in a big way, it came, like, so big. And it makes me scared.
The director of the Hyperbaric Medicine Center in Rishon LeZion, Dr. Shai Efrati, says MRI tests show that PTSD creates physiological changes in the brain.
We had the theory that it might be possible that actually severe emotional stress can cause damage to the brain, which is not less and sometimes even more than just mechanical injury. So it's easy for us to understand that stress can cause damage to the bone. For example, if you are running too much, if you put too much force on the leg, you may have stress fracture, we call it, okay, or stress injuries. So it happens to be that we can have it also in the brain.
He explains that the hyperbaric therapy works because of the fluctuation between 100% high-pressure oxygen the patients breathe through masks for 20 minutes and the normal air pressure they breathe when they remove the masks for 5 minutes. This extreme drop in the oxygen level is what triggers stem cells in the brain to proliferate and then repair damaged parts of the brain. The therapy is an established method for treating various kinds of injuries and infections. These Israeli doctors hope their innovative research in PTSD treatment will help veterans of both the past and the future. Their center is partnered with a Florida hospital treating U.S. veterans as well. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Rishon LeZion, Israel.
And that's it for this Tuesday, January 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, which you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have an amazing Tuesday.